Our next case for argument this morning is United States against Gunderson. Either of the lawyers in this case know why you have driven away the entire audience? I'll just wait till they have left. Ms. Christensen.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joanna Christensen, and I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois. I represent the appellant, David Gunderson, in this matter. Mr. Gunderson pled guilty to possession of child pornography. He received a sentence of 120 months, which is the statutory maximum. The district court erroneously applied two guideline sections in this matter and erroneously denied one reduction for acceptance of responsibility. The first issue is whether the district court erroneously added 5 levels to Mr. Gunderson's offense level based on 2G2.2 subsection B4, which states that if the defendant engaged in a pattern of activity involving the sexual abuse or exploitation of a minor increased by 5 levels. The application notes to this guideline section define both pattern of activity and sexual abuse or exploitation. Sexual abuse or exploitation is defined by the application notes in 3 categories: conduct constituting criminal sexual abuse of a minor, sexual exploitation of a minor, and abusive sexual contact with a minor, or similar offenses under state law. Simply put, there is no similar federal offense to what Mr. Gunderson was convicted of in Wisconsin. As the court is aware, he was convicted of having sex with a consensual girl.
I'm not sure why that matters. And if the guideline could have said sexual abuse of a minor only if it also would have been a crime under federal law on an Indian reservation, but it didn't. There's an express reference to state law, and everybody knows that states differ in how they define the age of minority.
That's correct.
This conduct would have been lawful in some states, but it was unlawful in Wisconsin.
That's correct, Your Honor. I believe that in addition to referring to state law, that application note specifically refers to federal law by using the exact words of art that are used in both the federal statutes and the sentencing guidelines.
But the guideline application note defines the pattern quite broadly to include any combination of two or more separate instances of sexual abuse or exploitation of a minor by the defendant. So even if, you've noted in your brief and, again today that Mr. Gunderson's prior conviction arose from 2 instances of sexual activity with one minor, wouldn't that suffice, to meet the guideline?
Well, I believe that it is defined broadly. It's a very broad guideline. And unlike other guidelines, essentially this is double counting because it's also criminal history, counted in criminal history if there's an actual conviction here. But you still have to look at the words of the guideline, which are not defined well, as in what constitutes criminal sexual abuse. I don't think that is something that is cut and dry. Those are terms of art that are used frequently in the guidelines and the federal statute.
Well, let me ask you this question. If the state crime, what if it was defined like the federal offense as sex with someone under 16, but required only a 3-year age difference? Would the enhancement apply then?
I believe we would have the same argument, Your Honor. I think that when it says similar offenses under state law, it's looking at the federal law and comparing under state law. And if that was the state law, that it would be under 16, but 3 years age difference, as it is in the criminal sexual abuse category, that you still have to consider throwing, not including that in this subsection, because it just doesn't fit under similar to federal law. The state law is not similar.
So you'd like it to be identical?
I don't necessarily think the wording has to be identical.
But that's really the argument you're making, isn't it?
Well, I think that if something is not criminalized by the federal government, it should not be punished more harshly by the sentencing guidelines because it's an offense in one state and not in the federal government or in other states. I think that part of the purpose of the sentencing guidelines is to ensure some sort of uniform sentencing structure. And when you have some defendants that perhaps committed the exact same conduct.
The whole justification of recidivist sentencing, of which this is sort of an example, depends on the law of the underlying jurisdiction, and it changes. Right? You can get convicted under, well, your sentence can be enhanced under the guidelines for being a career criminal if, for example, you have three or more prior named convictions. And those convictions are almost always state convictions under statutes whose elements differ.
Correct.
So I'm not sure why one would read the guidelines to say the underlying activity must have been judged under some uniform pattern. There's so many contrary features of the guidelines that position just can't be reconciled with.
I think that even in the criminal history, where you're going to have this problem more often, the criminal history category, there are allowances. The part of the application notes includes offenses by these names or any similar offenses under state law. I think that the guidelines allow for different naming and different charging decisions. But
exactly.
You still
if these had been criminal history points, for example, you could say, look, the precise behavior my client engaged in would have been perfectly lawful in Illinois. But Wisconsin has a higher age of majority, and therefore it's not lawful. But that wouldn't affect criminal history points. It just have to do with the fact that your client violated the law.
Right, and that's criminal history dealing specifically with recidivism, but this guideline is looking at a different angle, essentially. Essentially, we're looking at the angle of the link between prior conduct, and not just convictions in this case, it's any conduct that the defendant has engaged in that can be logically linked to child abuse.
Let me try it differently. Your basic argument is that the closest federal analog having to do with the special marine and territorial jurisdiction has 16 as the age of minority. But the application notes for this very guideline say, right on top of the definition of sexual abuse, quote, minor means an individual who has not attained the age of 18 years.
Correct.
So I take it that if Wisconsin suddenly changed its law to 19 years, and they what occurred here, the girl had been 18 and a half, it would not have been sexual abuse of a minor.
Under federal law?
No, under this guideline, no. We were trying to figure out what the guideline means.
Mm-hmm.
But we know from this definition that minor means an individual who has not attained the age of 18 years.
Correct. I think we still have to reconcile that with the reference to criminal sexual abuse, and that it's not a crime if the minor, and it still refers to a minor is still referred to as someone who's under the age of 18, but it's not a crime unless, A, it's non-consensual, it's forced mm-hmm. sexual contact, or the person is under the age of 16. I think that further underlying my position here is some legislative history, which is stated and quoted in United States versus Chapman, which is a First Circuit case. And the amendment sponsors, it's cited in my brief, the amendment sponsor cited the need for higher offense levels to those who possess child pornography and to punish those individuals involved in situations where a link between child pornography and sexual abuse can be established. This court has held in other cases factually that are more supported by that guideline. The Lovas case and the Polson case are the cases cited specifically in my brief, where there is that logical link between previous child sexual abuse and possession of child pornography. That link is not present in this case. and I don't think anyone can argue that it is, he had consensual relationships with a girlfriend when he was 22 and she was 17 and a half. I don't believe that that's a precursor for later possession of child pornography, which this subsection seeks to punish more harshly. Unless the court has questions about that, I will move on to my second argument, which is regarding the distribution enhancement that Mr. Gunderson received. The district court concluded that under the 1998 version of the guidelines that Mr. Gunderson had distributed child images of child pornography. The 1998 version of the guidelines is different from it is, than it is today.
Why should the 1998 version be applied? The statute says to apply the version in force at the time of sentencing.
Correct, unless it implicates ex post facto problems.
No, that's not what it says. The statute says apply the guideline in force at the time of sentencing. Now, courts have said that when doing that violates the Constitution of the United States, it can't be done. But this stuff about implicates ex post facto. No, you have to show that applying the guidelines in force at the time of sentencing would violate the Constitution of the United States. What is it about applying the guideline in force at the time of sentencing that would violate the Constitution of the United States?
Well, Your Honor, to tell you the truth, I don't know. This case, that wasn't a litigated issue. All the parties believed and agreed that the 1998 version applied to this case. I'm not sure I can speak to that. It was not an issue I raised. And the government hasn't raised that either.
Normally, we carry out acts of Congress, and the act of Congress is quite explicit. It says apply the guideline in force at the time of sentencing. And there's no doubt whatever that under the guideline in force at the time of sentencing, these five levels were properly added, right?
I agree with you, Your Honor. If he had been sentenced...
Now, what we have sometimes said is that this ex post facto question depends on whether a change in the guideline really jacked up the penalty or whether instead it clarified what had been an ambiguous guideline before or something like that.
Correct.
And part of your argument seems to be, gee, the guideline in 1998 was kind of ambiguous about this. But in that event, it seems to follow that there's no, that the current structure of the guidelines clears up the ambiguity. There's no ex post facto problem, so we apply it. I mean, that is, one would think, the normal approach to this question.
Well, Your Honor, I would disagree respectfully that I'm not arguing that the guideline in 1998 was ambiguous. I believe that this court has had definitively interpreted that guideline. It may have been in dispute with other circuit courts at the time.
Exactly. That's one way to find out that something was ambiguous. We kind of view it one way, and other circuit views the same language a different way, and then the Sentencing Commission comes in and says, what we really meant was X. Let's clean up the problem.
Right.
I thought that was just a paradigm for where it was fine to apply the guideline in force at the time of sentencing.
I believe that the change to that guideline was a substantive change. It changed the structure of that guideline from making it based on the retail value to making it based more on a distribution for a swap or in kind, such as this court had suggested in the United States versus Black case. I see I'm into my rebuttal time. I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay, Ms. Christensen. Mr. O'Shea.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Tim O'Shea for the United States. I will address them in the order that my...
I hope you'll also spend some time on the acceptance of responsibility issue, even though Ms. Christensen didn't, because that's the question that principally concerns me, but
okay.
Well, you will want to address all of them, I think.
Well, let me do it this way then, Your Honor. The first thing, because they logically flow one to the other, let's talk a little bit about the distribution first, because it was on the distribution that the district court, the denial of distribution that the district court decided to not permit a downward departure for acceptance of responsibility. I respectfully submit under the 1998 guideline, or now, the guideline now in effect.
Well, it's simple now. Why were the parties talking about the 1998 guideline?
Because
that the statute expressly specified the use of the 2001 guidelines in this sentencing.
I think, Your Honor, the parties in district court didn't think it all the way through that way. That's the way I look at it. Either way, the 98, or now it's a wash. There is no ex post facto issue. Now, if we look at it now, because under under the 1998, even under the Black decision, clearly this is bartering. This is trading, and under Black, that was appropriate. It's worth noting that the district court expressly noted in a way that it was a watch, because the district court said that he would refer to the guideline now in effect if this adjustment was not appropriate under the 1998 guideline, that he'd apply the guideline now in effect under the United States versus Coe. And the district court did that at sentencing on pages 35 and 36, indicating that the distribution using the 98 guidelines was inadequately considered. But even under the 98 guidelines, clearly this was distribution for four different reasons. First of all, Mr. Gunderson set up his server with this Panzer software, where he distributed child porn.
What are these references to Panzer, by the way? Is that the name of the software package?
Apparently it is, Your Honor. Yep.
Apparently? Do you know whether it is?
They don't call it software within the pre-sentence report, but we do know he had something loaded on his computer that was called Panzer, and it's not a piece of hardware. Consequently, it's got to be the software. It's got to be the program itself. In any event, this Panzer system was set up so that one traded. One gave one megabyte of data and got back 3 megabytes. And I think it's worth noting the crucial, somewhat obvious, but crucial distinction between digital distribution and distribution of other contraband that this court sees all the time. One can distribute digital images over and over again, and one's wealth in digital media is not shrunk, is not diminished. One distributes cocaine, one not necessarily has less cocaine, but digitally can reproduce over and over and over again. That's why, although it seems like the 1-for-3 distribution was unequal, in any event, at the end of the day, it was a net gain every day for Mr. Gunderson. The next three reasons also show that the defendant actually knew he was distributing child pornography. The defendant organized his pornography images into different categories or subdirectories. He had one animal and so on and so forth. But in particular, as it relates to this case, he had one labeled preteen. In other words, he took the images of child pornography and he put them in here. The third reason is the defendant actively promoted child pornography on his system. And it actively promoted people coming to his system. Recall that he went to a chat room where he was contacted by a German police officer. It was labeled 100% preteen girl sex pics. Not very subtle. Clearly, he's trying to promote people coming to his system for child pornography. And the last reason is the defendant's neighbor, Sue Strickland, told the police that she went over to the defendant's home and
threw any of these facts disputed?
No, but they do bear on the point I'm going to get to next, Your Honor, and that is that the district court...
This is the reason why I'm concerned about the acceptance of responsibility. If the defendant concedes all of the facts, perfectly willing to stipulate all of the facts, why does it justify a denial of acceptance of responsibility for the lawyer to stand up and argue what legal significance is attached to these facts? That seems, at least somebody coming to this from the first time, to be what's going on.
What the lawyer distributed, and I've got the lawyer's July 18th, 2001 letter here, and I'd like to read the court a portion of that, because for instance, he says, to allege that distribution existed here is flagrantly wrong. I'll flesh it out here. What the attorney wrote was that Gunderson's own statements do not veer from admitting that he possessed / downloaded images of child pornography / in the word period. He was not involved in any scheme or plan which served to place these or other images back into the global canals of e-commerce.
Right. Wasn't Judge Shabazz focusing on the fact that Mr. Gunderson factually denied having participated in a scheme or plan to transmit images from his computer into interstate commerce? Isn't that what he was focusing on?
Yes. What happened is, in this letter, and then the district court appropriately questioned Mr. Gunderson under the court laid out a protocol to follow in purchase. The district court followed that protocol and actually made sure that Mr. Gunderson himself denied the fact of distribution.
Well, even in the first page of the letter the lawyer wrote, didn't he say beyond simple possession there's no factual basis for this assertion?
Of distribution?
Right.
Yeah, yeah. And the district court checked with Mr. Gunderson, wanted to make darn sure that it wasn't just a lawyerly argument, that it was in fact Gunderson's position that he was denying distribution. So, and Mr. Gunderson, yeah, he said he did. And that denial is a denial of relevant conduct. And consequently, the district court was not clearly erroneous in deciding to deny the adjustment for acceptance of responsibility. So those two issues kind of go hand in hand. The first issue is so unambiguous, and that is whether he engaged in, you know, the pattern of sexual activity, that unless the court has questions, I'm not inclined to get into it. I appreciate the court's attention.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. O'Shea. Anything further, Ms. Christensen?
I'll comment on the government's argument regarding acceptance of responsibility. And I certainly am not waiving that argument. I just didn't get to it in my previous time. Acceptance of responsibility in this case was so clearly intertwined with the distribution issue, which, looking at the record as a whole, was a legal argument. And I believe that that legal argument, we still have to get to the 1998 version of the guidelines, which counsel was arguing about, whether they were appropriately applied or not. Nobody disputed it, so they were arguing about subsection B2 as it existed. And he was using the facts from United States versus Black and looking at the legal implication of those facts and that guideline to Mr. Gunderson's case. And, in fact, the government, who is different counsel today, I acknowledge the government conceded that this was a legal issue at the sentencing hearing, which is on page 2 of my appendix, said that he believed that this was acceptance of responsibility and that he was merely making a legal argument about distribution. And
if you're denying such basic facts,
could you articulate what, in your view, Gunderson was conceding and what he was denying?
I believe that he was conceding the factual, what had been admitted in the PSR, that he set up this file, the way the Panzer file, the way the file worked, that exchanges were made. He never denied that he traded images, both benign images and images of child pornography, or that other people traded with his system. He did not have to be actively involved at the time. And I believe that when you get down to talking about...
So in your view, this is a dispute over diction? As all the underlying facts were admitted, but he disputed the right word to be used to describe these facts?
Distribution, yes. I believe that the word distribution is kind of loosely used both in the guidelines and in the United States versus Black case where they talk about distribution.
It's not loosely used in the current guidelines. It's used exquisitely clear definitions.
Yes, it was. However, in the 1998 guidelines, it wasn't. And
so the real dispute, as I get it, is that you think that Gunderson was quibbling, and the prosecutor thinks that there was some substantive denial here, and perhaps the district judge thought that, and we have to figure out which is which.
As to relevant conduct, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, and I believe the case law is clear that when the defendant admits all relevant conduct and merely makes a legal argument as to the effects of his relevant conduct to the guidelines, that he cannot be denied acceptance of responsibility, even if the legal argument is not a successful one or not all legal arguments are going to be successful at sentencing, but that does not give the district court a license to deny acceptance of responsibility.
Are you arguing that it matters that his computer sent and received files automatically?
That's not a direct argument that I'm making. I think that it is a consideration, Your Honor, in that under the new guidelines, I believe that that would be distribution. However, under the 1998 guidelines, that is unclear, and my argument is that it would not be. It also has something to do with relevant conduct. He admitted that that's what it was doing, and he set it up to do that.
Right. He is the one that set it up.
Correct. And unless the court has further questions, I respectfully request the court vacate Mr. Gunderson's sentence and remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel.